At 0800 hours, prisoner Murphy,
through carelessness on his part, was found dead in vent shaft 17. He seems to have been sucked into a ventilator. Prisoners Boggs and Rains are missing. There seems to be a good chance that they have met with foul play at the hands of prisoner Golic. We need to organize and send out a search party. I can only hope we are able to all pull together over the next few days until the rescue team arrives for Lieutenant Ripley.
It's here. We got Clemens.
Stop this raving at once.
I'm telling you. It's here.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Alien Retrospective Series.
Is this going to be a stand-up fight, sir, or another bug hunt?
Join Garrett.
Check it out. I am the ultimate badass.
Yes,
state of the badass art. You do not want to fuck with me.
Matt.
I work for the company, but don't let that fool you. I'm really an okay guy.
And Adam.
You've been in my life so long. I can't remember anything else.
As they go to another system and investigate the popular horror science fiction series where no one can hear you scream.
This is so nuts. I mean, listen. Listen to what you're saying. It's paranoid delusion. It's really sad.
From the 1979 original.
Take a look at this, man.
All the way through Alien Romulus. This newest installment coming out this year.
Did IQs just drop sharply while I was away?
The boys will examine each film individually and find out what the company's real intentions are.
Looks like love at first sight to me.
So strap yourselves in, podcast listeners.
Stand by.
The Percolated Media Alien Retrospective begins now.
Let's go!
Prometheus, released June 8th, 2012. Budget on this was $130 million. Box office, $403.4 million. And this was directed by Sir Ridley Scott. I don't think it can be overstated how much hype this movie had coming into it. It kind of started when there was inklings of this being an alien prequel around 2010-ish was when that word started coming out. And then towards the release date, both Lindelof and Scott were in the press saying, well, it has strands of alien DNA in it, but it's not exactly an alien film. But yet the trailers, the marketing, everything told me that this was going to be an alien prequel. And hyped didn't even begin to describe how excited I was for this movie. I could not wait for Ridley Scott to return to this world and Ridley Scott to return to science fiction. Because as Matt detailed, Ridley Scott's oeuvre up to this point was, to say it was hit and miss would be kind.
Yeah, this is his first return to science fiction since Hannibal. I wish I could have shared your excitement, but I could not bring myself to get to that level of anticipation for two reasons. One, Ridley Scott is as hit or miss as they come, but that's also inherent in nature when you put out one movie basically every 2 years, sometimes multiple movies a year, which he's done, especially since a lot of them were not science fiction. Once he made Gladiator, he's like, oh, I'm just going to make prestige pictures, and sometimes he made a couple movies where I'm like, did you just take this for money? Like, he did Robin Hood, where I'm like, you could have gotten anybody to make that movie, or what have you. And the second thing was, after those Alien vs. Predator movies, I wanted this franchise to just get sucked out of the proverbial airlock, never to be seen again. I think once you do that, you're almost on the brink of no return, at least in my eyes. That is the nuclear option for we're out of ideas to do the big crossover. If you remember, both Freddy and Jason, after their Fisticuffs movie, they went back to square one. So by that logic, I will say it made sense to do this, kind of going back in time, more stripped down, all things considered. But I wasn't excited.
Boy, you sound like David Goyer. He said, once you make a Versus movie, you have completely diluted both characters.
Yeah, except I'm not the hypocrite and wrote Batman v Superman.
Goyer also thinks that She-Hulk is just designed for Hulk to fuck. So fuck you, David Goyer.
You know who agrees with you, though, Matt, is James Cameron. Because Cameron, Scott, and Weaver, they were all pitching ideas to do Alien 5. And they were all set to do that together. Cameron was actually developing it with Scott. And then 20th Century Fox said they were going ahead with Alien vs. Predator, which Cameron said would completely dilute the Alien franchise. And after that, all plans for Alien 5 went down in flames. Go back and listen to our reviews to hear us say whether Cameron was right.
James Cameron being the harbinger of a borderline prophet, surely that's never happened before. Except clearly he wasn't paid enough. Because I'm sure if they added a couple zeros, he would have said they were as good as his movie. Especially if you've seen those Terminator press junk.
That is the best film since Terminator Genisys.
Yeah. Now, Adam, Matt and I have both given out 10s on this retrospective. You have been the one who's been in the middle of this thing. What were you thinking when you were hearing that Prometheus was coming out?
Thinking I had a one-year-old at the time. So it was tough. I was excited that Ridley Scott was returning to Alien. I think Sir Ridley, like so many of those classic directors, I think of Miller also, just deserve some grace to make their films, especially in the franchises that they created or started. So I was excited when I heard that it was Alien adjacent. That made me more excited because I didn't necessarily need a sequel after what we had gotten before. I've grown to enjoy 3 and 4 quite a bit more, but their reputations, especially at the time that this was being talked about, was not stellar. AVP, listen to it. I actually enjoyed that one enough. AVPR is flaming pile of burning and Pred Alien 2. And then that it was, ooh, it's going to be about the space jockey. Suddenly you got ears perked up. And I'm like, I don't know if I need that story, but I really want to see what he does back with sci-fi. So that's where I was excited about. And yeah, there have been talks. I mean, everybody that's either was a big name or had made a indie movie that caught on big supposedly was making an Alien film. I mean, there's been more names attached to Alien franchise than there has been standalone Wolverine movies. And I thought this was a really good way to go. You know, I think so many of the other directors just love saying that they've taken a shot at it because they're getting paid $1 million to go write a script for 3 months. But who knows? I thought Scott was a great choice to come back.
Well, once James Cameron put himself in Pandora, he'll be there till he dies. So I was not surprised when he kind of took himself off the table. But to Adam's point, the people who are excited for Ridley Scott to come back, I'm like, yeah, you guys all said that in 1997 when George Lucas was coming back to Star Wars. You know, sometimes it's that be careful what you wish for. And look, Ridley Scott, yeah, Alien's a great movie, but I don't like Blade Runner. And those are really his only two big science fiction movies. Yeah. I jokingly say Hannibal is the third thing into science fiction. I mean, hell, that movie's almost a fantasy in a lot of ways.
And he's done fantasy, too. Go back to Legend.
Yeah, Legend he did, depending on your beliefs, Kingdom of Heaven is fantasy.
And some say this is. So let's get to the making of this. So after AVP, both those movies come out, around 2009, the studio was really going after this guy by the name of John Spates. Now, John Spates was a guy, he had this spec script that was being shopped around, and it was being called the best science fiction movie never made. Boy, that sounds familiar. We've discussed that before. But this script was called Passengers. It eventually got made, and by the way, it got made into a terrible film. But it's awful.
Horrible.
But Spates was really, really getting a lot of buzz about this. So the studio picked him up, and they wanted him to write this script. He wrote it, but Scott got it and said, you know what? There are too many allusions to Alien. I don't want to do this again. I don't want to do this again. I don't want to do this again. So Scott's the one who called a gentleman by the name of Damon Lindelof to come and do spice-up work on this script. You know what? Say what you will about Lindelof's writing, and I'm sure we will during this podcast, but he is a very charming guy. I listened to an interview with him this week to gear up for this, and he described the process of writing a script for Ridley Scott, which pretty much consists of him and Scott being in a room, Scott not stopping smoking cigars, one after another, blowing smoke in the air, and yelling through the smoke, I want this scene, this scene, this scene, this scene, this scene, as Lindelof is scribbling these scenes down. And then at the end of the night, he has to kind of put them in order. I can't imagine the hell that he went through while writing this. It took him 8 months to do a set of drafts that were good enough for both Scott and the studio to say, yeah, go ahead with this.
As far as Lindelof goes, I was not one of the people who said that was a harbinger of doom when he was attached to this because, look, Lost was one of the biggest shows of its time. It was one of the shows everybody watched. even if you were not into science fiction. But I watched that show for no other reason but to talk shit about it. It is the show, and they have admitted this. They wrote it as they were going along. There was no plan. They were changing stuff on the fly, and it clearly shows on screen. But that show is so ambitious with a lot of the stuff they were doing. And when it first started, it was really captivating. And I can tell you the moment the show lost me, that, no pun intended, God, I totally forgot that I said that, when they introduced the smoke monster. That's where they kind of lost me. But he's redeemed himself with The Leftovers and with Watchmen. I think both those shows are exceptional. And Lost was, I attribute a lot of that also to Abrams and his bullshit, so I'm not going to put Lindelof solely in the crosshairs, but his attachment to Prometheus, a lot of people took that as, oh, this movie's going to suck right off the bat. And I said, no, let's give it a chance.
As somebody who has only watched half of the first season of Lost, I can't really attain to his writing on that show, but I can attain to him helping write The Cowboys and Aliens, another just terrible film, which I'm not going to attribute all that to him. There were tons of writers associated with that. So
Adam likes that movie, so be careful.
That thing is fun. One, it's a comic adaptation, first of all, so I don't put all the blame on him. But as someone who's never seen Lost, that movie has just the balls to be fun, and that's what I love about it.
Yeah, I thought that was the movie that was going to make Daniel Craig say, I'm done with Bond and all this franchise bullshit.
God.
Nope. I don't know how we get attached to that. That's such a weird bit of casting.
Well, we're going to get weird casting in this, too. But I got to tell you, guys, these trailers were released. I went to Comic-Con with footage being shown. I was hyped. Now, Matt, we've gotten your take. And Adam, we've gotten your take on how hyped we were for this. But when I went to this screening of this, I came out. They were passing out posters, Prometheus posters, which I had. I got home and I was like, you know, I'm not real sure how I feel about this. So I went and saw it again the next day. Literally, I saw it first night it opened about 8 o'clock, and then I went the next day at like noon because I also had to write a review of this that had to be posted by Sunday. So I had to see it again on Friday, and then I just had to process my thoughts and process my notes. I was not sure how I felt about this movie, but after thinking about it and seeing it a third time, I came to the conclusion I really did like it. Go back to my review. I think my review is on my Letterboxd. It's still there. Adam, did you see this in theaters even though you had a one-year-old?
No, I didn't. This was something that I came across and watched later. My wife, Laura, actually watched this with me, which for those who don't know, that's a massive achievement because she will not watch horror movies with me. She is scared to death of everything alien. When I'm watching for these, she just happens to walk into a room as a chest verse or as a facehugger jump song. She's got the worst timing in the world. But no, this was something like as soon as it got released for home, that's how we watched it. To your point though, and a lot of the news that came out, you know, as the review started and things like that, I think everybody was confused. And I think as we got closer to the release, everybody was confused because it felt like this went from in the alien universe, but not an alien movie to it's an alien movie. And I think no matter what anybody went into this movie expecting, I don't think that's the movie that they got. And I think almost everybody kind of had to recalibrate once you watch this once to decide what you're going to think of it.
What I thought we were getting was I thought we were getting what happened to the space jockey before the Nostromo discovered it. And everything that happened there, which led into what Ripley ended up fighting at the end of that first film. I thought we were going to get the evolution of that. And I think you're right. I think I went in with the highest of expectations, thinking that was the world that Scott was returning to. And that just wasn't it. So I think that was my confusion, is as the huge Alien fan, I shouldn't say I was disappointed, but I just left confused. Matt, did you see this in theaters?
I did. I went as close to opening as I could because this was one of those movies I was really worried about spoiler culture because I knew it was going to be very contentious. Now, having said that, I had no idea this movie was going to spark the debates that it did. I mean, this was Man of Steel before Man of Steel, in a lot of ways. If you were on any sort of film discussion page or forum, or even if you just posted your opinion, you had shots being fired. So I wanted to see it as close as I could. I only saw it the one time in the theater because this summer it was like there was a big movie every week. We had a Spider-Man movie, we had Men in Black 3, we had a new Bond movie coming out that fall. So it was cool that we were getting so many big franchises either taking that next step or having a return to basics. And one thing we haven't talked about, I thought the viral marketing for this, which I normally don't like. I think this is the best use of it since The Dark Knight, where they had stuff with David, almost like a tech demo. They had Guy Pearce shoot some stuff, doing like a TED Talk. I liked how it was all the ancillary stuff, though. It wasn't giving you a lot of detail as far as what the movie was going to be about.
I think I watched maybe one or two of those videos, and I saw an interview with Ridley Scott where he said that him and Lindelof put those together, and they were shot by Scott's son, actually, because they wanted to kind of help clear up whether this was connected to Alien or not, and I don't think they did that.
They did a marvelous job.
All right, so we open up with a blue-tinted 20th Century Fox logo as the film starts, and we are in space, gradually moving through the clouds as the opening credits appear before us, and we land on a waterfall with a spaceship hovering overhead. We see a guy in a robe and black eyes. He puts down some sort of disc, opens it up, and drinks the contents as he opens his robe, coughs, and we go deep inside him to see the cells and organs break before falling to the water below, and then the Prometheus title card appears. Very odd opening, but I'm going to go ahead and say right off the bat, I think this is the most important scene of the film.
I thought I was watching a National Geographic documentary because it's like 5 minutes before you see engineer. But I will say, this movie was made to be seen on the big screen. I don't think I have seen a better incorporation of practical effects and backdrops mixed with practicality since like Avatar. I think it's almost on that level. You know, it feels alien enough. Not alien as far as Xenomorphs and this franchise, but alien as far as like another world. But I thought this was cool, although I could have done with a slightly more condensed pan through the landscapes.
It should be said that this was shot by the guy who did the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and he also worked on Dark City. So we are getting some real pros here, and I'm going to say, no matter what I have to say about his direction, I think Scott does a marvelous job with the visuals here. I think this movie is gorgeous, and you're absolutely right. This needs to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
This thing is astoundingly beautiful to look at. My first note is exactly what Matt just said. I feel like this thing opens and I'm watching a nature documentary. But not just that. You remember when IMAX used to be like a special thing at theme parks? You'd go and there'd be an IMAX movie theater and you'd go and you'd watch like a nature documentary or a space documentary. And back when IMAX was special, that's what this looked like. This thing opens like this and some of the shots of Interstellar. There's few movies that look just this astounding on the screen. I'm absolutely blown away. And then when we get what happens, I just can't believe that like 5 minutes into this movie, I'm sitting here going, holy shit, we just watched the birth of human civilization or the creation of humans. And I was just blown away that we get that and we're a few minutes into this film. That's bullshit.
What exactly happens here? What I took from this is this guy went rogue because we see the spaceship overhead. So that's where they are. But here he is, he takes this stuff down, this black goo, which when I think of black goo, Matt, I don't know about you, I think of X-Files. He takes it, he ingests it, and we're seeing his organs just digest. And so are we to believe that this is the creation of man right here?
To me, this is the primordial ooze that starts off evolution. This is what starts the single-celled organisms here on this planet.
Yeah, I think this is definitely, you are seeing the birth of civilization as we know it. You know, this is a movie that has a lot on its mind, at least conceptually, so I like that they're starting big.
We go from there to two characters we're going to be following the rest of the movie, or at least most of the movie. First, Elizabeth Shaw, played by Newbie Rapace, and Charlie Holloway, played by Logan Marshall Green. Now, I was a pretty big fan of Rapace, as I had seen her in the Millennium Trilogy, which is the Dragon Tattoo series, for those who don't know. The only thing I had seen Green in was Grey's Anatomy, as the chick I was with was a huge fan, and I was forced to watch that show for about 4 seasons. It should be said, Newbie Rapace was not the first choice of the lead role. The first choice... Now, Matt, it's ironic that we talked about Mad Max earlier this year because the first choice was Charlize Theron, but there was supposed to be a Mad Max 4 being filmed, and so her schedule was not free. But as we discussed in that podcast earlier this year, the schedule did free up because of certain things that happened as far as dust storms and things getting wiped out on that film. As bad as she wanted to work with Ridley Scott, she took the smaller role of Vickers, which was supposed to be Michelle Yao. She was supposed to have that role, but she was taken out when Charlize Theron became...
Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, Angelina Jolie was looked at for that as well. But Poor Michelle Yao. Eventually she would get an Oscar, but she was kind of kicked out of this production when Charlize Theron's schedule freed up. But here we have Rapace, and you know what? As much as I liked her in those Dragon Tattoo movies, I do not like her in this movie. I think a lot of it has to do with her hairstyle. I think the hairstyle just looks weird. I don't know if she has the presence of a leading lady. She's not the Ripley that they were trying for here. I don't like her in this movie.
It's good that you're going to start off so wrong so early in this. I think there's a couple, and I think one of them's the problem, and that's, what's his name, Logan Marshall something or not. This dude that plays Carly?
The failed clone of Tom Hardy.
Fucking just wet towel thrown against a wall. Dude is deaf to all the scenes that he's in. I think Noomi is fantastic. I think it's problematic, and I have this problem with every movie in the Alien franchise that is not Alien 1, 2, 3, and 4. They have a need to keep putting a female lead that you're going to compare to Sigourney Weaver and the character of Ripley. And that's almost impossible to do. But I think Noomi Rapace does a fantastic job for most of it. We're going to get into some parts where I hate some of the dialogue she's given, but I think she is astounding in this movie. I love that she's here. I think if you would have flipped, and I think Charlize in this role, I think would have been a huge detriment to this movie, and I love Charlize Theron, but I don't think this would have been the right role for her.
She could have taken this character to such depths, as we saw 3 years later when she took on Furiosa. I wish I could have seen her just go through what this character goes through, because I think she could have done really well. All right, Matt, be the tiebreaker.
This is a Ewan McGregor situation where my problems are not with her performance. It's entirely with how this character is written. Having said that, this Diet Tom Hardy is Hayden Christensen, where I think he's aggressively terrible and is a black hole of charisma and enjoyment. I get nothing of chemistry between these two whatsoever. And given that this is the foundation in a lot of respects that this whole voyage is predicated upon, their experience, their bond, and what they discover, that's a big problem I can't get past. But to Garrett's point, I could swap Charlize into this role and it would be better, but I cannot say the same about putting Noomi Rapace in the Vickers role. I don't think she would have pulled that off either.
Now, these two are on some sort of archaeological dig as they come across some old writing on some stone walls that is the same configuration as others that were found at least 100 years ago. Shaw thinks that whoever wrote these shapes wants all of them to come find them. So we go up in the ship Prometheus, which has a crew of 17, and we see David looking at Shaw's body and getting footage of Shaw's father, played by Patrick Wilson, by the way. I forgot he was in this movie, telling her that soon...
Yeah, uncredited.
Telling her that sooner or later everyone dies, like Elizabeth's mom, and that everyone has a plan for someplace beautiful. So he's seeing her dreams. This was weird.
I was trying to figure out if it's her dreams, memories, what this is supposed to be. I gotta say, it's always weird seeing Patrick Wilson, look up his filmography, and you're just like, holy shit, this dude's got the most interesting career. This is a weird part, because, what is David doing, the why, and for whom? But it's also, there's no doubt as to what he is, you know, right off the bat.
We cut to David bouncing a basketball and riding a bike, trying to get a response to his message. So David is played by Michael Fassbender. Now, the year before, he was obviously Magneto in X-Men, really made a big splash on the American market with that film. He had been a widely known actor up until then. Of course, he was in Inglourious Basterds before that. So he was known, and so I liked the fact that he was here. I think he plays a robot pretty well. I like him as David. In fact, I think he is the most magnanimous performance in this film. I really enjoy him.
I love how you almost had some of the time called him the most magnanimous presence. So this came out during a period, basically from Inglourious Basterds up until Assassin's Creed, where Michael Fassbender was probably my favorite actor working at the time. I was a fan of all of his choices, everything from Magneto to Steve Jobs. I don't care that he doesn't really resemble him. He got the essence down, and that's what I want in biopics. Even in the bad X-Men movies, I thought he gave it his all. And here, I think he is, certainly magnanimous is an appropriate word, but much like Noomi Rapace, I have massive problems. And I think there's a delineation between what Fassbender is doing and what the writers are attempting to convey. I love his body language. I love that he has a distinctive walk that he based on like an Olympic swimmer, which is why he moves robotically, but not in that Tin Man type of way where you're expecting to hear clanking. You know, he's got good speech patterns. He also, I don't think he ever blinks throughout the entire movie, which is a good choice as well.
Ah, the Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's your Hannibal connection right there. Maybe Hannibal was a robot, but as we get into the movie, I had more issues. But much like those bad X-Men movies, I can't put it on Fassbender's shoulders. And this is honestly my favorite part of the movie, him just walking around, by himself watching Lawrence of Arabia and in a perverted way invading people's consciousness while they sleep.
And of course, him playing basketball reminded me of Ripley in the last film that we watched.
I think he's good, but I'm always kind of put off when someone's just playing a robot. There's something that loses me when someone's playing a robot, when they're just being asked to be just unemotional. I think Fassbender does a fantastic job in this film. He does a Steve Jobs in this film. But I've just seen him be so great in so many things that to me this is like, okay, this is Michael Fassbender. I don't get the specialness that his talent usually brings to a role out of this film.
We see David learning a European language and watching Lawrence of Arabia as he resays the lines from that particular film. He then goes to a pool table as he heads to the hull of the ship and looks into space. Now, was this set of scenes supposed to just give us a tour of the ship like Scott did in the beginning of stages of the first Alien film? Because that's what I thought of. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, it's also, you're removing the ambiguity of him being an android, because one of the things that's different is in the first Alien, if you remember, Ash is asleep with the rest of the crew. So I like how David is sort of the overseer as the android, making sure that this is going well. So like the whole idea of like you're getting past the trope of evil robot, which this franchise has done before, at least initially. Turns out there's some other stuff going on that certainly evokes Alien. But I like how you're setting something up a little bit different as far as the pretense.
Yeah, I think it's a great way to walk through. I mean, we get a complete layout. We know everything of this ship right here. I gotta say, if this was Alien, we wouldn't have even had a reveal of the letters that say Alien yet. The title card. This movie is just very, I don't want to say fleet-footed because that sounds insulting, but it's expeditious in the way that it is getting through the information it needs to convey right here.
We get a hell of introduction to Meredith Vickers as we see Charlize Theron doing push-ups and
naked push-ups.
Naked push-ups. There's some footage of her doing it wearing a bra. You know,
my version was a bra.
Yeah, I get that they want her to come off as this bitch because of who she ends up being, and God, I can't wait to get to that. But God, I wish Theron had played the Noomi Rapace role. I don't like her here. I just find her off-putting in this role.
This could have been a well-deserved break from the Wayland employee, the board member, or the corporate person who turns out to be the villain, because we've seen that in this franchise before. But instead they write her just to be a one-note bitch, even though a lot of the decisions she makes later on are perfectly sound decisions that she is wrongly vilified for because the movie treats her like the villain. And then when you find out the root cause of all of her, I guess, malcontent, it feels like such a cheapening writing ploy. So I think everything with this character is, from my perspective, bad, underwritten, and a waste of Charlize Theron's talent. She got better stuff to do in those Fast and Furious movies than she got in this.
Now, Adam, you like Noomi Rapace in the role that Charlize Theron was supposed to do. How do you like Charlize Theron in the role that she's doing?
I think for the most part, she does pretty good. I think we started having issues when she got back into it. I could see the studio deciding, hey, we just got her. You need to have her do more. And this, and this, and this. And I think that's kind of evident because it feels like some stuff got rewritten and added. I mean, the whole is she or is she not an android, that doesn't matter, but that feels like it's supposed to be teased throughout this film for at least about the first half or two-thirds of it to really no reason. So I think she does good until she doesn't, if that makes sense, but I don't put it on her. She was supposed to be one role. You took her out. You cast and wrote for somebody else. And then when she's like, hey, I'm free, you kick that other person, bring her back in, you're rewriting again. And I think when you do that, you lose some of the nuance to write a character for an actor.
And that android point that you just alluded to, I remember having this conversation at the time, that if one of your big debate points was whether or not she was an android, then the movie has failed with what it's trying to talk about. Because that's not the primary focus.
Yeah, at least one character asks her if she's a robot. So, like, they want you to think about that. That's the worst part. David tells Vickers that there were no casualties in the trip, and he goes to wake up Shaw, who's not feeling very well. I like this little food distributor. Far cry from when we were on the Nostromo in the first film, isn't it? I found a lot of the stuff on this ship pretty innovative and fun for them to go through.
I like the scene in the introduction to everybody quite a bit. It reminds me of the original Alien. We're back to having a dinner scene, breakfast scene, whatever you want to call it, to reintroduce and decide where we are. And I dig it. I think it's a good choice by everybody involved here. So, yeah, I'm a fan of this quite a bit.
You know, for a movie that was marketed heavily and the director kept telling us, it's kind of its own thing, even though it's an Alien prequel. There's too many instances where they're replaying the same beats. Like, this is something we've seen in all but one of the previous Alien films. So it feels like one of those, it's like embedded in its DNA, like this black liquid, where we're doing it because it's an Alien movie and it's a beat people expect. There's a lot of things in this movie that bother me. And part of it is just that struggle of, okay, how much of a prequel is this? While at the same time, how much of this can we make independent as its own self-contained story? And this is just part of my problem with prequels in general. I find it very hard, nigh impossible, to do that. Especially with something like Alien that is so well known. Like, even people who have not seen Alien or Aliens know the iconic scenes or lines.
We then cut to Yannick, played by Idris Elba, putting up a Christmas tree. Again, this is another actor, very well renowned. At this point, he had been on The Wire. Of course, he was in Thor before this, so he had gotten a little bit of Marvel experience as well as Ghost Rider Part 2. I don't like him in this either. I see him trying to do a southern accent, which is bizarre because it goes in and out. He was known as changing his accent around times when he was on The Wire. Another actor who was really looking forward to working with Ridley Scott, but I just don't like him in this role.
All the weird shit he does, like the accent and the Christmas and the Crosby, Stills, and Nash bullshit, feels like Idris Elba pulling stuff out of his bag of tricks because there's nothing of substance written for this character. And you could say that about 95% of this cast.
I'm so glad he's here. Like, he's a welcome presence. It's amazing, though. This is when, and when I'm rewatching it for this, did Ridley just really, really like the MCU? Not only do we have Guy Pearce, Charlize Theron, Michael Fassbender, not the MCU, but Marvel. And, I mean, it goes on and on. We got Benedict Wong. We've got Idris Elba. There's five. I want to say there was six.
You got Logan Marshall. You got non-Tom Hardy, who was the Shocker.
We get the villain from Mission Impossible. It's amazing when you look at the cast of this movie. Idris feels, I don't know, suddenly I feel like there's a human on board. I think that's been missing. So, yeah, I don't mind him, because I find that he's actually a fun presence and someone who's just, he's that down-home boy that I feel like we haven't got in the last couple films, but we had in that first Alien.
Meredith asks Yannick what that Christmas tree is about, and he says it's Christmas, but she doesn't feel like celebrating. We then get to know a little more of the crew as they are eating, and then we cut to a briefing done by Meredith, who says it's her job to make sure that you do yours. And we get a huge presentation that looks like the one Scientology meeting I attended years ago. And it's being given by a very ridiculously made-up Guy Pearce. This is fucking silly. Why? Because this was going to be Max von Sydow, but when Lindelof had written a scene that comes up later, they realized they couldn't throw Max von Sydow around. So they get Guy Pearce here, they put him up in this terrible ghoul makeup. The big twist that comes later on is fucking telegraphed about an hour before it actually happens. And everything that has to do with this character of Wayland, I fucking hate.
Was Christopher Plummer busy? Because this makeup is out of the Watchmen school of bad old movie effect makeup. How did this come out after Benjamin Button and it looks worse in every comparison? And why is it that these big movies don't know how to use Guy Pearce? For such a great actor, a lot of these big movies, they don't know how to incorporate him. And I could see why he's always been hesitant. Because he watched Memento, and I thought that guy should have, you know, his career should have taken off. And I like that he gets these big movies, but it also doesn't make any sense because he shot the marketing stuff as a younger Wayland. Why do the bait switch with this unnecessary makeup? It looks terrible, it's distracting, and you're right. Bigger question. He's financing the whole fucking mission. So why does he feel the need to hide? It makes no sense.
And Hyde, who his daughter is. Oh, my God. We'll get to that later.
And it starts right here when he says the closest thing they have to a son. What is the first thing they do? They cut to Charlize Theron looking disinterested and all hurt by that. So, like, that is one of the many instances they telegraph this shit. And this I do blame on Lindelof, because this is a hallmark of his writing.
I don't understand any of the decisions and how they came up with this. And yeah, to Matt's point, like, I think Guy Pearce is an amazing talent. It's funny, I didn't see Memento later, but from the first time I saw L.A. Confidential, I was like, damn, this guy's just, he has a presence. He's got to have the worst agent in Hollywood, or he just really doesn't care what he does, because he gets some of the just shittiest movies sometimes, or when he gets a good movie, he gets abysmal makeup, or he gets abysmal makeup in a shitty movie, but we'll save that one. So I just don't understand some of the choices for somebody that is such a good actor. And then, because it's so bad looking, there's no surprise. There's no doubt he's coming back. There's no doubt who his kid is. You completely pull any suspense by having this done the way that it is.
So Weyland talks about some mumbo-jumbo questions of where do we come from? What is our purpose? And what happens to us when we die? And as Matt said, he goes on to say that David is as close to a son that he will ever have, even though he's not human. So we get that question out of our minds real quick. Anybody who didn't see the marketing campaign. He also says that Charlie and Shaw are in charge of helping them find the answers to those questions. And the time has come for Prometheus to come back from being cast from Olympus. And they will be equal to gods.
I think this is when we see that what this movie at least started out being was Ridley dealing with some ideas as he was getting older and really wanting to flesh them out, like a lot of artistic people do. And I think everything in this movie really has to do with Ridley Scott facing mortality and how he feels about that.
To that point, I think this is a movie where you can clearly see all the disparate elements throughout this movie's development being stitched together, sometimes by duct tape. I will say it's amazing the movie holds as well as it does. Like, it's not incoherent. It doesn't feel like it was directed by multiple people. It's not that level. But I do see a lot of different strands that I have no doubt were from previous drafts or visions of this movie.
Yes. All the ideas were not hashed out in this, and it does feel jumbled up. I completely agree with Matt on that. Charlie puts down a Rubik's Cube that shows the results of their archaeological dig, which is what we saw in the beginning of the film. So big people worshiping stars is a unique thing? Okay.
Yeah, this is where this whole thing has been organized and paid for on the flimsiest of evidence.
I feel like that, just the whole archaeological dig and everything that came out of it, I feel like that was left over from a draft of Alien vs. Predator. Like, that just feels like, specifically that part of it, like, that's kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, and this feels like, I swear to God, this must have been like a Jurassic Park sequel at some point, because he's John Hammond, where it's, I'm going to show up to a bunch of diggers and say, I'll pay you to go do something for me, and it all goes horribly wrong, and it involves creatures of some kind. And, you know, there's a lot of that playing with God stuff in Jurassic Park, too, that permeates this as well.
Weyland says that their planet has a sun like ours, and the planet that the digs pointed them to, which depicted engineers, they're the ones that engineered us. There are, of course, questions of how they came to these conclusions, and Shaw just says that she doesn't know for sure what they mean, but she chooses to believe. So Shaw is the believer, and Charlie is the what? The religious compartment, the one who thinks about it in a religious point of view.
So is she. That's the whole crux of her character, and this is where I have to question
the cross.
I have to question the writing, because she says she's confronted by the Sean Harris character. He says, like, what leads you to believe? You're going to throw 300 years of Darwinism out the window? She goes, yeah, because I choose to believe. The movie's not presenting a debate from her side. It's just, we're going along with it because she's a creationist, and you just have to roll with that. And in science fiction, you need a lot more of a substantial argument to get me on her side. And this has nothing to do with my own religious beliefs. Because he brings up a perfectly valid point. This is in the future. We have clear evidence of Darwinian theory. And she's like, oh, we're going to do this just because I choose to believe. Even though there's no substantial evidence in those drawings of them being like creators. Like, you don't see conception. You don't see any iconography that recreates like the birth cycle. Only on her like intuition that they're doing all this. I get Weyland is desperate, but I find this to be incredibly loose.
To me, that line is specifically what made me think that there was more going on here for it, because he talks, you know, you're going to give away 300 years of Darwinism. And I think that is Ridley going, you're talking about 300 years, which is, that's a blip when you talk about the universe. And I think that's kind of the point in this, that they're talking about 300 years when even the religious person isn't so much of a zealot, that she realized that we're beyond just the current time frame that we understand.
So Charlie and Shaw, they're taken to Meredith's room, as Shaw just can't stop touching all the pieces of machinery inside her place, including a machine that does bypass surgery.
Oh, Chekhov's medical device.
This will come into play.
They got technology of the Enterprise. She's got her own holodeck.
Meredith says that on the offhand chance they do see the engineers, they aren't to engage them. Just report their findings back to her. And by the way, she drinks vodka straight up, so there's a woman for you.
Now, I got to say, we have spent longer talking about this than it is to get to this point. We're only like 20 minutes into the film, maybe 25. Mm-hmm. This is all being decompressed, given out ridiculously quick. All this is going while we're en route to the planet.
Now, Matt, you know his writing better than either of us. Is this part of Damon Lindelof's writing? Is this in that same vein of what he's done before?
Well, it's kind of a lost trope where they'll introduce a conflict, they'll talk about it for 2 minutes, and then just run to confront it. Like, that show, for a lot of it, is just an escalating series of puzzle boxes, where it's like you close one, and then another one opens 30 seconds later. And there's really no through line. This, at least, I can follow. Well, for most of it. But I do think I find a lot of this to be very flimsy. Especially for a movie that is trying to be so big and heavy in its themes. I don't really think that comes across in the actual characterization and certainly the dialogue. A lot of this is very stilted conversations.
Yeah. Meredith says that the company paid trillions for the findings and then for them to bring Shaw and Charlie here. And then she says that the only reason they are here is because Weyland wanted true believers. David describes his thesis as Yannick brings them down for a landing. We're hearing that CO2 keeps increasing, and we're actually seeing the landing happen.
Beautifully. Yeah. This landing sequence is gorgeous to watch. And it's amazing because every film we've talked about landing on the planet, and this thing is gorgeous to watch.
Holloway points to a specific canyon and says that God does not build in straight lines and insists that Yannick take them down there. You know what else I'm loving is I did see this in 3D when it was first released. IMAX 3D, I went all out, wanted to see it on as big a screen as possible. And I think of all the movies that were released post-3D in the 3D era from those early 2010s, I love the way it uses 3D. This view from the cockpit, I'm very impressed with the way this film looks, and I'm impressed with the way the 3D technology is. Now, Matt, did you see this in 3D?
No, because I was exhausted by that trope, even by this point. Having said that, I think the panoramic shot, you can see as he's standing there, it's this giant wide shot where you can see the canyon. There's like windows underneath where they're standing, so you get the full, it almost matches the scale of a movie theater screen. I think all this is really good, and it's great in science fiction to see a landing that doesn't go horribly wrong.
One of the things that, and it's tiny little thing, like blinking you miss it, but as they're pulling in after he notices God doesn't build straight lines, go over, but they have, and we discussed this in a different alien film, there's Nazca lines on this planet as they're getting ready to go do their descent, or as they're descending, getting ready to go land. And that ties into previous stuff we've seen, but it also shows that there's more to this planet than meets the eye, and it's a blink if you miss it moment. You don't even have to blink and you might miss it. To me, there's something beautiful about that because it connects it to our own planet before we get to the engineers.
Charlie says it's Christmas and he wants to open his presents early, so he wants the survey team to suit up and explore even though there are only 6 hours of daylight left.
Even though you blinked 5 minutes ago.
There's more than enough time to drive 5 minutes.
Shaw insists that there not be any weapons as this is a science expedition, and she just gets a, yeah, good luck with that. In return.
Okay, that is such a bullshit line because that's like opening Jurassic Park without any Rangers. And look, even Star Trek, where they are diplomat and altruistic, they still carry phasers, because you never know. This is so nearsighted. And look, I'm going to start this now. There's a reason this movie's release was accompanied by the hashtag of worst scientists ever.
I actually have an argument against that when we get there.
Well, it depends. Some of the ones I am perfectly okay with looking over, but some of the decisions are so egregious, I can't help but laugh.
Again, I have defense for it. David says he wears a suit to be more like them, even though he doesn't need it. Charlie tells Shaw that this is one small step for mankind as they land. We hear Prometheus, we're going in as the group make their way into the caves. So, as they're walking in these caves, is this supposed to give us the same feeling we got when watching Alien? I know I keep making these comparisons, but it's kind of forcing me to.
It's also a nearly identical time point. If you look at the duration, and it's shot with that almost found footage-esque POV with the looking through their helmets. So I think he's very much evoking that with intent.
It's funny, because time-wise, it's almost there, but I feel like this is getting there so much quicker. We get into this thing and start mapping it at a 30-minute, and that just feels so fast. Maybe it's because of how movies are now, but man, that feels quick. Mm. And that's not a complaint. I just can't believe, and if I hadn't stopped to pay attention when I was taking my notes, I never would have thought that we were actually only 30 minutes into the film at this point.
Well, I'll say the big difference also is that, and this is a point against this movie, I don't feel like I know these characters anywhere near as well as I knew the characters in Alien or Aliens. I know Alien has a little bit of a easier lift because there's not as many, but the characters in this are nowhere near as distinct and interesting as what you get in Aliens. And I know everyone's going to say, oh, this is a prequel, you know, look at it as its own thing. I can't bring myself to do that considering how much of this movie also reminds you that it takes place in the Alien universe.
You know what was great in 3D? Were these red beams that emit in these caves. Even if I don't like the pretending to be a werewolf and howling at the moon, I did like when they released these red lasers and they're guiding them through these caves. I thought this was really cool looking.
Why does the geologist carry those?
So they don't get lost.
Yeah, but the geologist is not the cartographer on an expedition.
We hear that outside is toxic, and in these caves, the air is completely breathable.
God. Would you still take that risk?
No, absolutely not.
This is stupid.
Charlie removes his helmet, followed by Shaw. David is impressed by what he's finding on the walls, which awaken the engineers, and they start running through the caves as the engineers catch wind of what they are doing.
It looks like the detective vision for the Arkham games.
Don't understand the how and why if we get a bad VHS playback of what happened here before, other than this is video exposition just to let us know what had occurred sometime before. This doesn't make sense or ever get explained.
Yeah,
I guess there was a continuous tape recorder going 24/7.
Something's playing it back where they can all see it.
They see a decapitated engineer as Vicker says, son of a bitch, they were right. But the geologist isn't interested in leaving. He's interested in the rocks, not dead bodies. So he decides to stay. David opens another door as they find what I'm guessing is an egg. They also see a mural and explore some more as David finds an organic substance. Shaw runs to bag the head that they found as they start getting signs that a storm is headed their way. Vickers is adamant that she's going to be closing the doors in 15 minutes, so they better head out. Very much like Ripley did in that first film.
Yep, and this is not the only beat they'll play with her. But also, like, I don't understand, why is she being such a hard-ass? Like, there's no
and even though we get the reveal, and fuck it, I'm not going to tease it, she ends up being Waylon's daughter. So, even with that baggage, I still don't see why she's such a bitch to all these fucking people that she brought on board.
I think it's to tease us that she's still not a person at this point.
David is still gathering samples, and I'm going to say, this whole set of scenes involving the storm are awesome. Scott is really filming it in a harrowing way, as we get a ton of upscale shots, and Shaw is thrown from the storm, and the storm makes its way in. I think this storm is awesome. Matt, we talked about storms a lot when we talked about Fury Road and Furiosa a few months ago. How do you feel about the storms in this?
I think it's really cool, but I hate the borderline comedic thing of, oh, I have to go back and get the thing that rolled out of, my hands. It's like that scene in Godfather 3 where, trust me, everyone, I'm going somewhere with this. You know there's the part where there's the big mob meeting and the helicopter goes and shoots everybody? And there's a part where the guy goes back and he's like, I have to go back for my lucky coat.
Adam will get to that eventually. Adam, how do you feel about these storms, sir?
The ship closer to where you need to go. We'll never understand why you don't park closer. And it's funny, we discussed this in more than one Alien film already. I think it looks beautiful. I like the escalation. I like what it does. I think this whole scene looks fantastic. And I am bought into what's going on. I like the changes. I like the nods to what came before. I am really bought into everything going on.
I'm perfectly entertained. The movie's not wowing me on a character or certainly a dialogue level, but I also appreciate that the movie, much like the original Alien, it's taking its time. And I have to applaud this for coming out in an era where when you think of science fiction, and particular Alien films, you get stuff like Battleship or Battle Los Angeles, you know, these really dumb, bombastic action movies that are science fiction in concept only. As flawed as this movie is, I'm happy that it exists and came out at this time because it's still a contrast to the vast majority of what was coming out.
I forgot about Battle Los Angeles.
I did not. That's one of the worst movies
I've
ever seen.
Meanwhile, these geologists are still looking for rocks, and Yannick says that the temperature is dropping rapidly, so they better hurry up and get out. Meanwhile, Shaw takes the head that she found inside the lab, and Vickers is just none too happy. They open the helmet and see the head, which has new cells. They get it to start moving and coming to life as they move it out of the line, and it blows up.
Yeah, it's full of the scanners.
David makes his way to Vickers, and they continue with the mystery that is solved the minute Guy Pearce showed up, and David says that he said, "Try harder," which, let's spoil it now, was geared toward Vickers, his daughter. Shaw still examining the DNA that is believed to be one of us, as David examines more of the black goo, to which he says, "Big things have small beginnings." I remember that part in the trailer.
Yeah, well, this was a big, like, money shot from the trailer, and this is also where I had a problem with the writing. David is constantly reminded throughout the movie he has no emotion, but he continually shows emotion throughout the entire movie. And it's never addressed. All you have to do is say he's developed his own artificial intelligence that they could not account for, and it's resolved. But there's too many instances where he smiles, where he's sarcastic, he's petulant, he's sneaky. Clearly, Lindelof is not thinking this through. Especially with how many times the characters remind him of it.
David joins Charlie for a drink, and we know where this is leading us. Charlie is sad that they didn't meet their makers and get answers, and David says how disappointing.
Okay, this is the dumbest part of the movie, and I'm going to explain this right now. Just because day one is a failure does not mean you turn into Eeyore and say, oh, the mission's a failure. Why is he so depressed compared to everybody? Just go back the next day.
He's dumb. We've established this.
This guy makes Ralph Wiggum look like a member of Mensa.
David says how disappointed Charlie would be if their makers said that they were disappointed. And then David pours Charlie a glass while dropping the black goo inside, and Charlie responds with, "Here's mud in your eye." Good one, Lindelof.
You know what I think is really important here, though? Because I think that David is actually following on a smart level. I think David is following the three laws of robotics. He does not do that until Wish Tom Hardy says he's willing to do anything. It's not till he says it that then he dips his finger in the drink.
Yeah, I caught that too.
So I'll ask this question. Is he doing this on Leland's orders, or is this his own fruition?
I feel this is his own fruition. I think he saw the writings on the wall, literally, and he's trying to do what the maker said that he couldn't.
The first time, even maybe the first few times I saw this film, I figured everything he was doing, he was programmed to do. This time I see more and more that he's grown beyond his programming, and he's trying to become, if not more human, greater than his creator. And I think that's part of the theme. So, yeah, I think this is him doing it on his own because he's trying to find out about his creator. The only way to do that is to figure out and to meet his creator's creator. So I think there's levels that way.
Matt, I'm assuming you think it's Wayland who's programming him to do this.
I don't know, and that's a problem. I'm fine with ambiguity, but don't over-explain certain things and then not explain other things whatsoever.
Ding, ding, ding. That is the whole crux of this film, isn't it? And that is something that, coming into this, I thought that we were going to get more explanations. I thought we were going to get stuff explained that we didn't get in that first film all those years ago that was so perfect the way it was. But we're not getting those. We're not getting any of that. We're just getting this android fucking with this crew. So, yeah, no questions are answered. And God, that's a problem.
And the questions that are answered are the ones I didn't want answers to.
Meanwhile, the geologists, they're still in the cave, and Yannick says they better be ready because he's starting to get a ping that indicates a moving life form is with them.
How is it that the guy... All right. Maybe you have an answer. How is it that the guy who mapped out this whole place is the one who gets lost?
I don't have an answer.
Spiral.
Again, worst scientist ever.
Shaw wonders if there was an outbreak, which caused the engineer's head to explode. Charlie shows up to Shaw's room with a rose, and here we have a love scene that is the cause of so much grief in this poor gal's immediate future.
Speaking of head exploding, this is Matt. His head exploding at this point.
Shaw refuses to take her father's cross off, and Charlie says that there is nothing special about the creation of life, and Shaw responds with, "What does that say about me?" Vickers and Yannick have a back and forth about Stephen Stills, Matt's favorite part, and then Yannick successfully gets her in the sack. Hey, it's Christmas, right?
Everybody wants to be Idris.
This is Idris why Elba. Everyone wanted Idris Elba to be.
I was just about ready to say, this was the time when people were really talking about him being James Bond, and yeah, this is a great rehearsal for that.
I mean, they're still doing it, even though he's in his mid-50s at this point.
Still out there DJing, he could do it.
Meanwhile, the geologists, they're smoking a bong amongst the caves, and they see a liquid that forms into a snake. This snake has a little Giger in it, as it looks a little like a vagina. And by the way, Giger did do designs in this. He approved a lot of the designs that were not done back when he did the first Alien. So a lot of his stuff is here. And I definitely got a more Gigerist feel for this. Adam, as the Giger fan, did you get more of a Giger feel during this film?
I do, as it gets deeper into the film. I think when we first get into the cave, it's not really there. I think when we get some of the designs, it's definitely Gigerized more than we have lately. But also this, I'm going to call it a mountain, but this mouth that they go into, there's a brilliant shot. If you've ever seen the work for Jodorowsky's Dune, and in fact, there's a great documentary right now, I think on Netflix, some of the Gigers work on that. This mountain that's got a face, if you, again, blink and you miss it, is a direct pull from what he made for Baron Harkonnen. So there's definitely more Geiger in this one than we've seen recently.
Look, no matter what I feel about how the scene happens, I'm glad that we do get the scene because we are in a science fiction horror film and we needed horror, so I think the scene works pretty well. Now, I know people have said these two are straight from a Friday the 13th sequel. Believe me, I get that. And I love the acid in the helmet. I think that's great. I think the snake in the helmet is an awesome visual. But here's where I'll defend it. These two are geologists looking for life on this planet. Who's to say they would not go and touch this thing? Who's to say if you were in this situation, you would not do the same thing? I cannot put myself in this situation and say I wouldn't. That's my defense for it. Matt, I'm assuming that you just hate this because these two are idiots.
The only reason I give it a pass is because they were smoking pot right before this.
That's true.
But the fact that they're smoking pot in this context is the part I don't like. So the action is not the issue. It's the action that led to this result that I question.
I mean, look, if everybody died every time that they reached out and stroked a vagina like an item, where would any of us be?
I'm last man standing.
That's why it also turns into a, you know, it turns into a dick at the same time. I like the scene a lot. I like the snake look. I love that it's a different design. I'm not nearly as hard on the scientists, because I think every movie has got, in this franchise, has got dumb people that don't act the way that they should. So I'm not going to come across harsher on this film than I am Alien or Aliens because of it. So they're a little dumber, but I also like their performances. I like this. I mean, to have this horror moment, because we've seen the elevation from the second they stepped in this room, from when it started dripping to when they started oozing to when it started spreading through the floor. And Numi's character mentioned that they changed the atmosphere inside here, which is what happens when you break into a tomb in Egypt, even. So I love that kind of correlation to all of this. And the way that it wraps around him and just the sound of it breaking his arm and that acid just dissolving that helmet around his face is, I mean, we just suddenly jumped into the horror that we've been waiting for.
Meanwhile, Charlie notices his eyes turning black and Yannick radios to say that he can't find the geologist. David goes back in and Vickers demands an update. And he walks in much like Aliens, and we're getting a look at what he's seeing from his point of view. So another allusion to Alien movies past. The guiding light leads him to a huge room where he finds more engineers, and then he turns off the feed. Now, this is when I kind of perked up in the theater, you know. Actually, it was probably when we got the horror scene. Like, from here on out, I'm pretty tuned into this film, and again, I want to see what David discovers here. This is when I know he's going to discover the space jockey, and we're going to get answers. Spoiler alert, we don't. Charlie tells Shaw to examine him, and she sees that he's not very good. The snake escapes as we get more POV from Vickers, who doesn't seem to be in a hurry to do anything. Meanwhile, David is visited by engineers, one of which plays a flute and opens up a whole bunch of controls. This was odd.
This freaking Link flute. Put a pin in it, but I can't believe that the flute was here. I had forgotten all about it until I saw it.
Yeah, I have expected him to start playing the Sun song.
David finds himself in a recreation of their world, and I have to say, two movies in a row, the score sucks. I hate the fact that this franchise has two movies in it that I love the music of and two movies in it I can't stand. I don't remember the music from last week's film, but this music, this score is just, it's terrible. Adam, how do you feel about this score?
I have no feelings about it whatsoever, which might be the biggest thing I guess I could say about it. I just rewatched it again and I remember nothing about it. I think the sound design is really well. I think that's done quite impressively. But the score, I remember zero about the score in this film.
Yeah, there's none of the score in the intro or outro to this show, by the way. The light show stops, and Davis spots a pod of some kind. Meanwhile, Charlie is in a bad way, suffering within the confines of his helmet, and Yannick yells for the door to be opened. Vickers grabs a flamethrower and says that Charlie is not coming on board the ship. Shaw says that she won't leave him. Charlie walks to Vickers, and my God, do I hate this scene. I really don't like this.
Okay, again, she is perfectly logical. Don't bring the sick guy onto the ship when we don't know what the contagion is. But then this idiot takes it one step further and lets himself be lit on fire. You could equate that to a mercy killing, but there could have been a better way to do that, just leave him outside.
Yep.
Because it looked like he was going to die any second. So, again, this is taking her to the nth degree when there's no logical reason to do so. Why did she bring the
exactly flamethrower? A scene that Charlize Theron hated doing, by the way. She was very uncomfortable with this flamethrower. She had to set this stuntman on fire. It really disturbed her. She hated doing it.
I like it, not only because I think that Vickers is, as Matt said, completely correct, that you're not getting back on the ship, even though we don't know really what they're even doing here on this, you know, to bring back on the ship. She's completely well within her rights, but Charlie knows that he's infected, and the best thing he could do is die. And yeah, he basically, like Prometheus, Vickers is the god bringing down fire and giving it to man. So that's exactly what we get.
We cut to Shaw waking up to David examining her, saying there might be a contagion on her, and grabs her cross. David asks if her and Charlie have had any intimate contact as she finds out that she's 3 months pregnant. She says that she had sex with him 10 hours ago, and David says it's not a traditional fetus. He refuses to let her see the fetus as she wants it out. Now, have you guys heard Ridley Scott's explanation of what the engineers are? Have you guys heard this?
No.
He says... God, he must have taken the same hit of the bong that the dudes used earlier. He says one of the engineers did indeed get to Earth, and he was crucified. Yes, he called Jesus an engineer.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. I heard that was in the script, and that Fox was like, uh-uh.
Well, especially because there is a Spear of Destiny illusion in one of the drawings, so that doesn't surprise me. It's still... God, that's stupid. Well, if you were going to do that, then... further explore the idea of creationism actually being science in the future. That's a really interesting concept to explore, but it's just pain. Mm-hmm. It's one line.
Shaw kneels down in pain as David gives her some sort of sedative and says that it must feel like your God abandoned you, and compares Charlie's death to her father's, who died of Ebola. He says that he's been watching her dreams, and then Shaw fights her way out and runs to get a cesarean, but the pod is calibrated for male patients only. Gee, I wonder what this means. She programs it to give her cesarean, though, and another scene, it's a very hard scene to watch. I love the grossness of it. I really like how Rapace is playing this as I feel her pain. What I hate about it is her getting up and running immediately afterwards. But this is a very harrowing scene.
It's so uncomfortable to watch. I mean, that's just how great it's shot and acted. It is uncomfortable, and I think that's a tribute to it. Her getting up and running right away, what I like is that injury is still there. She gets hit in it later. It still affects her. It's not like so many movies that somebody gets shot, they tie a bandage around it, and that wound never matters the rest of the film. Like, she's injured throughout the rest of this. But everything here, from even seeing that creature inside her for the first time, is just a what the fuck kind of moment. And we've had that type of sonogram look before in this series, but this is just, it takes it to a new level. When those forceps reach in and pull it out, good.
I don't know, man. She's running pretty quick in a few minutes. I mean,
she stabs herself multiple times with morphine.
Okay.
Without overdosing. I don't know if I squirmed in my seat this much during a movie since watching the last 15 minutes of Audition. Like, it's that level of discomfort. And you're right. This movie does acknowledge that she's stitched up every other scene. Like, there are parts where she's running full speed, no questions asked, and then other parts where she's grimacing like she's in danger mode in Resident Evil.
And why does she give birth to a squid?
Because somebody has a kaiju.
You know what? Speaking of which,
yep.
You know who really doesn't like this movie? Guillermo del Toro, because he was in the midst of developing Mountains of Madness, and a lot of the scenes from this movie were pretty much word for word from his script. And so he kind of abandoned it for a while because he didn't want to make a movie that was so similar to this. So this movie is a lot of the reason why we didn't get Del Toro's vision of Lovecraft's Mountains of Madness.
The design of this thing, I used to hate it. I appreciate it more now when it's first taken out of her because it's got the head. I mean, it looks like a sperm from the front. But then it's got these weird tails in the back. But when they open up, it's like it's got a vagina in the back. And that's just so geeker in its styling. But it's different. It's not the same thing we've had before. And at least freaking five movies in, or seven movies in, depending on how we're discussing it, I can appreciate that we don't know what the hell the life cycle is and how these things
develop. Yeah, I'm with you on that. I like the fact that we're seeing the evolution of this creature. By the time we get to Scott's first film from back in 1979, this is what it actually develops into. So I can appreciate that too.
Well, and here it makes sense, because we're getting it from a different version. Yeah. We're not getting a facehugger depositing an egg that becomes different things. And based on that, I'm going to reverse 30 minutes earlier. When they had that space jockey's head in the pod earlier, right before it exploded, if you notice, it looks like it's morphing into an egg, which was one of the original thoughts for Ridley Scott's Alien, after we chestburst that we became the egg that then formed again. I don't know. I think he's working out a lot of things he didn't get to do before.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Charlie gets up and goes on a murder spree. They shoot at him before finally just running him over.
Well, it's not Charlie, it's the Sean
Harris. Oh, is that Sean Harris? Okay.
Yeah, which also doesn't make any sense. Now this black goo can make zombies.
I hated this.
Like, I hate the omnipotent bullshit that this ooze can do. Whatever the plot wants it to do, it can make zombies, it can infect people, it can mutate stuff. It's just, this is the kind of stuff I don't support in screenwriting. Well,
smoke monster. I know that never watching law.
Speaking of horrible screenwriting, we then get the pointer scene as Shaw wanders into this room with a horribly done Guy Pearce makeup job, and he says that her job was to have him meet his maker, and Davis says one of the engineers is still alive. Waylon wants her to save him from death, and Shaw says that this place isn't what they thought it was, and that they were so wrong. You sure were. Ugh, fuck this scene.
This is why you do your research. I have no sympathy for this character, by the way.
Neither do I. And I think you're right, Matt. I don't think it's her as much as it's the writing. But at the same time, again, I think Theron could have played this much better. Shaw says that they must leave, and Waylon says that they can't, knowing what they are, and then asks her if she lost her faith. Shaw suits up as she puts on a suit, and Yannick says that this might be a military installation, and he says that they made it here and got out as they turned on us. So the fact that this is a military installation and they're using them as biological weapons, boy, Ridley, for a movie you didn't want to allude more to aliens, that's more alien than anything he's done so far.
Can I say from the moment Waylon is reintroduced, this movie goes down the shitter?
Yeah.
The last 30 minutes of this movie are almost intolerable for me.
You know, I got to say, we've had differing views of each thing, but I've enjoyed this movie, I think, immensely more than the two of you, and I think it's moved at a brisk pace. I think it's been extremely well paced throughout. For all the things you can say about it, I think the pacing's been fantastic. I don't know what happens when Guy Pearce comes back in, but you might as well just put up a stop sign, and I don't think that they have any idea how to pace the rest of this film. It feels completely different.
Well, let me go back. I am enjoying myself during this movie. I really am. I'm noticing a lot of the problems with it, but I'm enjoying the ride. And I'm going to differ from Matt with this. I think the finale of this is pretty remarkable. All this Waylon bullshit I could have done without, but that's explanation for the sake of explanation. And once again, it's not the explanation I was hoping for when I went to this fucking movie. So my feeling is the engineers turned on these people when they saw David create life with his drink. That is what I take out of the attacks going on here. Matt, did you get that?
How do they know that David infected that guy then?
We've seen that they're everywhere.
That engineer has no way of knowing that since he just woke up from cryosleep.
Well, I think because he realizes that they made David. I think he looks at David. I think he sees that David's not what the engineers made, that he is a synthetic from us. And That's unacceptable.
So it's not what David did, it's what David is.
Okay. That's what I take it as.
Yannick says that he just doesn't care, and that no matter what happens, he can't bring any of it back home. Meanwhile, Waylon suits up, and Vickers says that if he was going down there, he is just going to die. She then says it's inevitable that a king has his reign and then dies, and then says that there's nothing else, Father, before leaving.
This is the most unnecessary plot development in a movie that I've seen in a very long time.
Charlize has the ability to be a great actress. When these two are going against, they're both really bad against
each
other.
When she hates, like, somebody, she acts with them great. As me and Matt discussed when we did Fury Road, you're right. These two together, they have nothing.
Also, Guy Pearce was probably just exhausted from sitting in that makeup
show. Yeah, 5 hours it took to get in and out of this thing.
Either cast another actor or just, you know, have him be how he is in the viral marketing and he has cancer. A lot of this movie feels like Ridley Scott just doing shit because he felt like it.
David compliments Shaw on her survival instincts and then tells her, doesn't everyone want their parents dead? David promises that Charlie didn't get infected from the air, and he leads them to what looks like the space jockey. But of course, here's another problem I had with this. This is not LV-426. We are on LV-223. Because instead of being self-contained, this movie is telling us to come back next time if you want answers. Fuck that.
Yeah, the days of encapsulated franchise storytelling are over. This movie does the thing that I hate of, oh, this is the first part of a trilogy, so it's not going to wrap up until we get to the last two.
Oh, fuck. I did not come to this for that. David says that they were in the process of leaving before things went wrong and that they're headed to Earth. Because if one needs to create, they need to destroy. David opens the pod and wakes up a huge engineer who is none too pleased. Shaw says to ask him what's in his cargo and why he hates us as Waylon slaps her down.
Such a bad line. Can you ask him why he hates us?
He then grabs David and beheads him, a lot like Bishop in that second film. I kind of appreciate that, and attacks the rest of the crew as Shaw runs off.
Yeah, he pulls a Sub-Zero and does the spine rip from Mortal Kombat. But everybody else, he just punches and shoves.
Well, I think, as Adam outlined earlier, I think he's upset at the creation of David and wants nothing to do with it, so that's why he takes his head off, because he knew it was synthetic.
That's the problem I have, and this is why I hate this scene so much. This could have been, if pulled off correctly, the scariest idea in a movie of this type, where you finally meet your creator, and they want nothing to do with you. The problem is, these are not their quote-unquote creators, technically, so everything that's been built up to feels like treading tires. Now this movie has just become a stupid, dumb, horror sci-fi movie, where it's, we have to escape from the monsters.
Vickers says it's time to go home as she leaves the cockpit. Meanwhile, the spake jockey forms as the engineer gets inside and turns on what David was in earlier. A helmet closes over him and blows poor Shaw forward. She runs towards the ship, right after getting a cesarean, then tells Yannick and Vickers that they need to stop the ship they found from taking off. Yannick refuses to take Vickers' orders and handles the ship himself as Vickers heads to an escape pod. Shaw sees the ship blow up and come down towards her. She runs from it as she stumbles and rolls. I did really like Vickers getting crushed. I thought that was a nice touch.
So dumb, though.
But you don't know that as you're running. See, that's another... Yes, no.
You run away from the thing. It's a straight line.
But see, that's the thing. You don't know that as you're running. I can see, again, I can see the motivation of characters running like this, because you're not going to run sideways if you don't know for a fact where that thing is behind you.
The giant shadow doesn't give it away. Like, Adam, please help me out.
Let me laugh in hindsight. When I'm watching it, I mean, one, there's one or two shots that are a little hokey that make me chuckle, but it's become like its own meme and its own joke, running like you're in Prometheus. It's just, so, does it make sense? No. But it's only in hindsight where I'm just like, Jesus Christ, that's fucking stupid.
I mean, look, that is the ninth dumbest decision in this movie, so I'm not going to kill it too hard.
But I get more bothered that the Prometheus is here, the mountain is over there, but the ship that's launching is in the middle. Which means they walked over there, and then they walked like halfway back to the ship when they were in the, I don't know.
We think Shaw is crushed as well, but she's not. She crawls up from the mess and runs back to the ship as she's warned she has 30 seconds of oxygen remaining. She grabs an axe and walks through the ship. There's a huge tentacle-like thing that hits the door as David warns her that he's coming for her. So now David's communicating with her.
I have bought many of axe for the scouts in our troop and family, and that is the stupidest, most extreme handle on an axe I have ever seen, and I can't see past it.
The engineer attacks her, so she lets the squid out, and it overtakes him, opening its jaws and pulling him in. This ends up being the first facehugger, I believe.
I thought I was watching the end of Pirates of the Caribbean 3. Shaw releases the Kraken, or the hentai monster, whichever way you want to go.
Yeah, this might as well be a Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Again, that's why DeToro hated it. Shaw is on her back crying that she can't do it as David once again gets on the radio and tells her that he was afraid that she was dead.
Yeah, he gives his big Mickey speech.
Get up, Rocky.
He asks her for help as he says without him, they're not leaving this place. He says that there are many other ships on the system and that he can operate them. She goes back for him and she asks where her cross is. She gets it out of his utility belt and he wonders why she still believes. She says she doesn't want to go back to where she came from. She wants to go to where they came from. She goes on to say that she's wondering why they changed their minds about killing them. All stuff, again, that we're setting up.
I hate this whenever it's done. When I'm watching it specifically for our discussion right now, this makes me jazzed for what could come next. And I hate that kind of next movie teasing bullshit normally. Looking at MCU and DC Universe and the F word of franchise in the fucking movies anymore. But maybe it's the way she's delivering this end of the performance. Let's see where we're going to go.
It matters to Shaw because she's a human being and he's a robot. She apologizes before zipping him up in a gym bag and gives her final Prometheus report, which is New Year's Day 2094, saying that she's still searching as we cut to the engineer hatching what looks something like a xenomorph. I like this. I saw this in the theater. This was the one thing that got me to really perk up and say, yes!
Yeah, because it's dangling a shiny object in front of a cat. Here's this thing you know, even though we're not connected to aliens.
Well, that was a surprise. That's why I liked it.
It's not a surprise. Everybody should have seen this coming, and the fact that they play as a stinger is bullshit.
I didn't see this coming. I didn't think we would get one of these.
We shouldn't have.
And I guess that's why I liked it, because it's something I loved from those previous films. You know, and again, this is the evolution, this is the design, and we're going to expand on this next week, but this is the stinger for next week's film. Adam, how'd you feel about this?
I hated it in 2012. I've liked it when I've rewatched it since then. And I hate having a change of mind that way, but it's just, I like feeling like this movie is an evolution of what we are going to get later. So, yeah, the Neomorph, I think, is a cool design. I think deciding to make it a backburster instead of a chestburster is pretty fucking hokey. You know, no, we can't have him come out the front, so turn him on his back. But I like the design, and I think it's cool, and I think it's a promise for the future. Guess what? It's not, but I think at this point it's a promise to the future.
All right, scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Prometheus? My best friend of 30 years, Adam, you go ahead and go, sir.
This has been a film that I think of any in the Alien franchise has probably stirred the most contentious debates, not only between us three, but just in general. I think a lot of people don't know what to make of it, and I think those that do pretty much come hard on one side or the other. I didn't see a lot of the viral marketing. I saw some of it. I absolutely love the cast that's in it. I think this movie is shot absurdly well. This thing is one of the most beautiful looking films that you will see. The cinematography, the direction of photography is just, it's absurd how beautiful it is. The script gets wonky. It does go all over the place. I think Ridley Scott is working out some things, you know, with himself and some of his own creation thoughts and where he's coming from, where he's going to go. And I think that's what this movie is for him. I think Guy Pearce is an amazing actor, is such a fucking distraction in this film. And that's a shame. But I think Naomi Rapace is fantastic in this film. I think Idris Elba is a welcome jaunt of energy for the little scenes that he's in. I think Charlize Theron is fine, but I think she's playing it robotic because I think maybe they didn't even know till the editing room if she was going to be a robot or not. Fassbender is fantastic, but he always is. This, when I tell people I'm going to watch an alien film, this isn't one that I generally think of. But if I'm going to watch Prometheus, I'm going to watch Prometheus. And there's a lot of issues in this film, but I love it for the movie that it is. I love that Ridley is taking a big fucking swing. I resent the obvious interference by some of the inclusions in this film, because you could tell they got put in here, and that's the only way we were going to get some financing done, and that shit just bugs me. I think the first two-thirds, three-quarters of this movie not only work, but work very fast. It's for a movie that's only 2 hours, it's stunning, because you don't get that anymore. This movie goes at a, just takes off like a starship until Guy Pearce gets reintroduced, and it slows down, but then it finishes really strong. I like Prometheus. I like it a lot. It's not Alien. It's not Aliens, but I consider it a much better watch than 3 or even Alien Resurrections. I'm going to give this a 7. I'm not going to give it an 8, even though I kind of want to, because I got to make sure that it is a full step below Aliens for a very good reason. But I like Prometheus. I don't love it, but I like it a hell of a lot, and I think more than most.
All right, a 7 from Mr. Bunch. Goudreau, what you say, sir?
Well, before I give my thoughts, let me answer a point Adam just brought up about the Charlize being an android. That ties into my whole thing about, if you've seen Blade Runner, the whole thing, Deckard being a replicant. I don't think that was ever meant to be a thing until people started talking about it and Ridley Scott went along with it, because he's like, oh, that actually makes sense. So I don't think it was ever intended. Speaking of intention, this movie is like the cinematic equivalent of a polarized magnet. For everything it does well, I think it does something poorly. To quote a very niched show called Reboot, this movie is bucket of nothing. It surprises your friends, it'll amaze your family, and it will annoy perfect strangers. There's a lot of surprises to be had here. There are parts of this that were unexpected for good and for bad. Sometimes the obvious things were surprises because I was like, oh sure, they're not going to do this, and then when they bring Waylon back, I'm like, oh for goodness sake. It'll amaze you. A lot of times with the visual imagery, and I think some of the performances are pretty damn good. And this movie will annoy you, because parts of it are very flimsy, and I think it's the opposite of the saying, because I feel like this movie, the sum of the parts are greater than the whole. Because I don't think this movie works as a holistic piece, but there are components of it I really do like. And unlike Alien 3, which I feel like is just a disaster, I wouldn't go to that extent. I like this movie vastly more than Alien 3. And I'll always give a movie points for ambition, especially at a time where science fiction was not all that interested in being thought-provoking. But at the end of the day, I hate how this movie just turns into a stupid monster movie at the end, which Alien so elegantly dances around. So because of that, I'm going to give this the softest, pillowiest marshmallow 6 on 10 you can find. I can't give this movie a negative score if you're asking me the binary, because I applaud the ambition, and I respect what it's trying to say, and I think if this did not have the burden of all the changes and unfulfilled visions, this could have been great, but it just went through too many hands to entirely come together. So very, very soft 6 on 10 for me.
I love Ridley Scott for advertising what I thought was an Alien prequel and making a movie about existentialism. I hate Ridley Scott for marketing what I thought was an Alien prequel and actually making a movie about existentialism. There's one big piece of this movie that is its biggest flaw, and that is bringing in Damon Lindelof. Not for reasons that people think. Yes, we have not been kind to the writing of this, but I don't think it's all his fault. I think the problem with this movie is that it illustrates what me and Matt brought up earlier, in that it is the downfall of movies as self-contained films, self-contained stories. And my God, I know that the three of us are going to get in major arguments once we finally get to Marvel about the fact that they let some villains live. They let some villains die. Most villains are left living. And I hate that, because I want something solved. And this movie asks questions and answers questions that I never, ever asked or wanted answered. And that is its biggest flaw. I did not want Wayland and his daughter here. I wanted to know what happened on that goddamn space jockey. We do not get that. We'll tell you the beginning, but you have to come back in a few years if you want to hear the answers. Bullshit. And so the more I think about this movie, the more I really resent it. But at the same time, it is a beautiful film. It is a beautiful science fiction film, and there are pretty good performances all around, although I found Rapace, again, just to be a little too mousy. And Logan Marshall Green, I'm completely with you guys, where he was just too douchebag douchey to even like. But Michael Fassbender is Michael Fassbender. He will never be bad. But they waste Idris Elba. I feel in a lot of ways they wasted Charlize Theron. I want to see Charlize Theron in that Shaw role. Who knows? It might have been too much like Ripley, and we would have gotten those comparisons left and right. But I still think that was a role that she was kind of made for, and I'm sad that her schedule was not open enough to do it. But what do I rate it? That's the thing. When I first saw this, I ended up rating it pretty high when I went home and thought about it. And then I eventually made it one of my top of 2012. In fact, it might have been my top of 2012 when I rated the movies from that year. But in thinking about it now, it's definitely not the top of this series that we've been discussing. And it feels a little bit less than middle tier, but it's still going to land right at the bottom of it. I'm giving probably a stronger 6 than Matt did, in that I think there's enough going for it visually where you can really, really enjoy yourself, but don't go in expecting the things that you wanted answered in watching those first two films, especially answered in this, because you're not going to get it. Temper your expectations, as mine were so high going in 2012, and I think you can get some enjoyment out of it. So 6 out of 10 from me. Now, Goudreau, I'm assuming next week's movie is the one you're looking forward to reviewing the most. Am I right in that assumption?
As a podcaster, no. As a spectator, yes. This is a conversation that has been years in the making in a lot of ways, which we'll learn more about next week. For me personally, I didn't give a shit when this movie was coming out. I'm going to be upfront. 5 years later, I thought, unlike Prometheus, the trailers for this made it look like a cheap knockoff of Alien. I didn't know what to expect. And there was no Damon Lindelof, but the person they brought in, I have a strenuous, at best, relationship with the screenwriter of that movie, so I was the opposite of excited. I was dreading going to see Alien Covenant.
There are a lot of things to say about the development of next week's film, which I'll save for next week. What I will say, though, is the other gentleman on this podcast came out and he text me. He went on Facebook. He did everything he could to let his thoughts known that this is one of the worst theatrical experiences he'd ever had, and he was never going to watch it again. And then he joined this podcast. Adam, what are you expecting when we review Alien Covenant next week?
I can't wait to hear who the special guest is that gets to replace me next week. You know what? In 2017, I was looking forward to this movie huge because I wanted a sequel. I tried to avoid all the marketing for it, so no, I didn't see any of the clips that they had put on. I knew the cast, which I was ridiculously excited about. Fassbender, I love Katherine Waterson, Billy Crudup, I was excited. And then for those that have known or that have heard or anything else, yeah, I've made it clear, that's a movie I'll never watch. There's two movies that I would not only jump out of a plane so I didn't have to finish watching, I would crash the plane so that the rest of the freaking people on board didn't have to finish watching. And this was one of them. The other one's movie 43. So that's
right.
Now, I will say the theater experience itself was horrific. And I'll get into that when we do it. So that affects it. Now, I'm going to give it another shot. I'm going to watch it again. And I swore maybe I would just do a recap video to hold myself to it. But I'm going to watch it again. And I'm hoping I come out of it feeling better, because I find it hard to think that I'd come out of it feeling worse. But it might be.
And let's not forget, we are leading up to a review of Alien Romulus, which, as we record, is about 2 weeks away? 2-3 weeks?
And the timeline of that film just got spoiled for me, and I had no idea of when
that film
was set.
I still have no idea, so
just don't know.
And who knows? Maybe I'll come to that podcast and spew a lot of what Adam's saying he did in 2017, but like I said last week, my expectations are climbing as the days go by, so I'm getting kind of excited for a new Alien experience, one in which I am going to have to bribe my bride-to-be with Italian food in order to take her to watch it.
Yeah, my wife will not be going, so this is a solo view for me. So I may call, you know, I've talked about it from the beginning of all of these shows, connection with Alien and my dad, so I may see if he's up to going to see Romulus with me. That might be special.
Matt, do you have anyone in mind? Or is this a solo effort?
I'll ask Riker if she wants to come with me. Well, scar my child.
Until next week, when we get to Alien Covenant, big podcasts have small beginnings. Thank you, gentlemen.
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Now what the fuck are we supposed to do?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us!
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Could kill him. I'm willing to take that chance. Just cut it off and then.
You take responsibility?
Yes, I'll take the responsibility. Get him out of here.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How far would you go to get what you came all this way for? Your answers.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including Star Wars, the Mad Max movies, Avatar, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Stop your grinning and drop your linen.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Shit.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is edited by Garrett.
How are you, you stupid cat?
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You started this. Show me everything. I can handle myself.
Yeah, I noticed.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
They ain't paying us enough for this, man.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Thank you, that will be all.
God damn it! That's not all! Because if one of those things gets down here, then that will be all. Then all this bullshit that you think is so important, you can just kiss all that goodbye!
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
Commercial starship Nostromo. Third officer reporting. The other members of the crew. Kane, Lambert, Parker, Brett, Ash, and Captain Dallas are dead. Cargo and ship destroyed. I should reach the frontier in about 6 weeks. With a little luck, the network will pick me up. This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I thought Scott was a great choice to come back.
Well, once James Cameron put himself in Pandora, he'll be there till he dies. So I was not surprised when he kind of took himself off the table. But when Neil Blomkamp was talked about to do Alien 5.
Well, that was correct, that was after this, though. Yeah, that was after this. That was about...
Okay. I always bring it up because it was like an Alien 5.
Yeah, let's save that talk for next week because that'll really come into play next week. She's not the Ripley that they were trying for here. I don't like her in this movie. Matt, what about you?
Have Adam go first. Okay, I want to hear his take.
I mean, it's good that you're going to start off so wrong so early in this.
That's why I wanted to go to him.
I think... I don't know. There's something about a performance when it's just... Be unemotional. Bless you.
Say that line again, Adam. Say that.
I'm not a robot. There's your Turing test.
Adam, say the unemotional line again so it doesn't get sneezed on.
There's something that loses me when someone's playing a robot.
Including a machine that does bypass surgery.
Oh, Chekhov's medical device.
This will come into play.
They got technology of the Enterprise. He's got her own holodeck.
This is awesome. I watched Elysium.
I liked it better when it was in Elysium.
Man, there's a reference.
And that movie's garbage.
Oh, God. That movie's a PC statement.
But Meredith says...
And I have to applaud this for coming out in an era where when you think of science fiction and particular alien films, you get stuff like Battleship or Battle Los Angeles, you know, these really dumb, bombastic action movies that are science fiction in concept only. As flawed as this movie is, I'm happy that it exists and came out at this time because it's still a contrast to the vast majority of what was coming out.
I forgot about Battle Los Angeles.
I did not. That's one of the worst movies
I've ever seen.
But they did a Battleship movie, people. That's an alien invasion movie.
Oh, there's a story behind that Battleship movie that I'll tell at another time. But that was Hasbro thinking they were able to cash in on the Hasbro name.
Yeah.
And they were also making a Monopoly too with Ridley Scott.
Well, they said, hey, Transformers and G.I. Joe, those are stuff where... somewhat related to. Let's try it with
and
a board.
And here's Peter
game.
Berg thinking he's...
It worked for Clue, and
here's
that's
Peter
it.
Berg thinking he's making like a small-scale action film, and Hasbro was like, no, we're spending $250 million on this. You make this huge, and he's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, and that movie's so dumb that I'm almost surprised Mark Wahlberg
is
not
so
in
terrible.
It.
God damn.
You know, but it shows us that there is nobody in the Skarsgård family that has said no to a script yet.
Meanwhile, these geologists...
If you've ever seen some of the designs for Tartakovsky's Dune,
you mean Jodorowsky?
What did I say? Jodorowsky? Yes.
You said Tartakovsky, and I was thinking Old Wars.
Oh shit, I did. But Baron Harkin.
Go back to when you said the Dune. Whose Dune it was, so that I can edit that.
I'm going to do it again. Matt, I'm tying my tongue.
Jodorowsky.
Jodorowsky. Like, I see it, and I'm saying the T. But if you've ever seen the work for Jodorowsky's Dune.
Shh. Shaw goes on to say that she's wondering why... Oh, I already said that.